Chapter 1. At Venice with Holy Roman Emperor Friedrich III, 1469. It was in February of 1469 that Holy Roman Emperor Friedrich III, traveling from Rome, made his solemn entrance at Venice with a long retinue for which that which was to be his third and last official visit to the city which he so loved and admired. It was to be his first visit to the city of Venice since his triumphant reception immediately following his coronation as Holy Roman Emperor by the Pope in Rome in 1452. As was customary on these magnificent occasions, Friedrich spent entire days in diplomatic meetings and in receiving the official visits of ambassadors, and in conferring diplomas, stipends and privileges of all sorts upon beneficiaries selected from long lists of names prepared by his officials, as dictated by imperial interests and his own. In those days, intriguers, wheeler dealers and adventurers attached to the monarch's court, or who thought they were, toiled with a calculated industriousness to intercede in favor of various persons seeking official ratification of their own professional and economic success, of priests, patricians and academics bent upon crowning their own cursus honorum through the attainment of some precious imperial investment, or those of a variety of ethnic and religious communities intent on achieving confirmation of their ancient or recent privileges, not to mention merchants and intriguers intent on covering up affairs of dubious honesty and scraping up advantages for themselves during the solemn visit. Friedrich was known as a fanatical and often naive collector of relics of all types. It is not therefore surprising that the objectives of his trip to Venice should have included a passionate and unrestrained hunt for relics, hawked about in abundance by wheeler dealers and impertinent intermediaries at high prices, a fact noted with malicious humor by Michel Colli, a salt superintendent, in a report sent from Venice to the Duke of Milan, in which he cast doubt on Friedrich's alleged competence where relics were concerned. According to the Milanese official, the emperor, in this type of business, which he presumed to carry out directly and without regard to price, was a sucker to be plucked assiduously, adding, to accentuate the ridicule, half seriously half facetiously, that certain Greeks sold him dead bones including the tail of the ass that brought Christ to Bethlehem. On this occasion, some supposed relics of Saint Vigilius found their way to Venice in the hands of a loving and faithful subject of Friedrich, Giovanni Hinderbach, a famous humanist and man of the church who had traveled from Trent to the city of the Lagoons, not only to present the emperor with the highly valued relics, but above all as an act of gratitude, on the occasion of his receipt of his much sought-after investiture of the temporality of the Episcopate of Trent. Again, it was Colli who informed the Duke of Milan that his illustrious majesty invested the Bishop of Trent with 1,000 temporal solemnities and celebrations. But Hinderbach was not the only person to have undertaken the uncomfortable journey from Trent to Venice during the German Emperor's distinguished presence in the city. Tobias de Magdeburg was an obscure Jewish herb alchemist who, after traveling down from his native Saxony and finding exile among the mountains of the region of Trent, practiced the art of medicine and surgery with some success, at least on the local market. A few years later, he was to meet Hinderbach under much unhappier circumstances, under indictment for participation in the cruel ritual murder of little Simon, later sainted as Simon of Trent. Imprisoned in the castle of Bonconsiglio and admitting his guilt, he was to meet a cruel death at the stake, accompanied by the confiscation of all his goods. Maestro Tobias appears to have been acting in accordance with other motives during the Emperor's official visit to Venice, particularly the possibility of meeting large groups of German Jews arriving from the other side of the Alps along with Friedrich's baggage train, many of whom Tobias looked forward to seeing again after years of involuntary separation. There was no shortage of German Jews at Venice in February of 1469, disciplined, humble, but totally self-absorbed and self-interested. In his depositions before the judge of Trent in 1475, Tobias was not exaggerating when, after recalling his own presence in the city during His Most Serene Highness' visit to Venice, he stressed that many Jewish merchants, in crossing the Alpine barrier, had actually travelled from the German territories to the city of the Lagoons for the purpose of acquiring a wide variety of high-priced goods without paying taxes or duty of any kind, passing them off as goods owned by the Emperor, in whose baggage train they were said to have found their way back to Germany. This astute and bold stratagem was well worth the physical and economic cost of the difficult trip to the city of the Doges. But Tobias's presence in Venice was not due to any mere nostalgia for the people among whom he had been born and grew up. As a physician, and as a Jewish physician in particular, he knew that the Emperor, during his visit, would, as he was normally accustomed to do, grant doctoral degrees in medicine to a swarm of more or less highly recommended candidates, including a few Jews. In fact, it was during that same February of 1469 that Friedrich granted a license permitting the College of Physicians of San Luca, an institution of higher learning teaching students of various origins, not just Venetians, to confer the insignia of imperial authority upon 8 medical graduates per year. Ennio Silvio Piccolomini, later Pope Pius II, recalled the manner in which Friedrich graduated a swarm of medical students during his second visit to Italy. The number of Jews on the Emperor's lists of candidates remains unknown. Nor do we know who filed the petitions to inscribe these Jewish candidates, or the methods used, or the reasons for doing so. We only know that many Jewish physicians, of various origins, in addition to Tobias, a resident of Trent, were in Venice during the Emperor's visit, attracted by an opportunity of obtaining some much sought-after title from Emperor Friedrich in person. Nor do we know how many of them had already spent considerable periods of time in the city of the Lagoons in search of fame and fortune. Among them were the Jews Moshe Rapp, Lazzaro and the better-known Omo Bono Simchabano Morbanim, keeper of the Pharmacy della Vecchia at Sankashan, with a house at Zanstay, only a few steps from the Albergo de Bresciani, Magister Morbon, Jewish physician, at the Spezieria della Vecchia at Sankashan, with his house near Zanstay, not far from the Casa de Bresciani, at Venice. Accompanying them was the physician Wasnerodi, whose presence is attested to with certainty in 1473, but who probably arrived in Venice even earlier, and Maestro Theodoro Todros, Jewish physician, who reached Venice in 1469 with Friedrich. The best known of all, however, was, without doubt, the rabbi and barber surgeon Chada Messalian, certainly a product of Ashkenazi Jewish environment, if his origins at Montecchio in the Vasontino region are indeed a fact. This same Leon, who resided in Venice starting in 1469 at the earliest, where his son David was born, was officially granted his degree in medicine during the Emperor's visit, Although formally the diploma was only signed a few days later by the imperial notary at Pordenone, but still in the month of February. Similarly, years later, in August of 1489, the emperor, still at Pordenone, is said to have granted a doctorate in medicine to two Jewish candidates, both of them from Sicily and belonging to the Ozzini family at Palermo, David D. Aaron and Salomone Demos. The petitions of the Jews to the emperor, who had always been highly esteemed for his benevolent attitude, filed during his stay in Venice during the winter of 1469, were submitted by an ambassador admitted to Friedrich's presence for the particular occasion. The occasion was described as follows: early in the 16th century, with some satisfaction although with undoubted exaggeration, by the chronicler Elul Capsalia, rabbi of Candia, who had studied medicine at the Talmudic Academy of Padua, the emperor Friedrich III was very favorable to the Jews. During his visit to Venice in 1469, when his vassals and subjects presented him with gastronomic gifts, he never refused to eat them before his servants and functionaries had tasted them first, as is the custom among emperors. Whenever the Jews brought him gifts of this kind, Friedrich never hesitated to eat any of the dishes immediately, saying that he had complete faith in the loyalty and honesty of his Jewish subjects. Later, Frederick, traveling from Venice, went to Padua to gain an impression of that city. On that occasion, the Serenissima prepared a carriage for him and placed it on the city walls. The horses pulled the carriage from which the emperor admired the entire city. This was done so that he might easily verify the thickness and solidity of the walls at Padua. Friedrich signed a pact with Venice and remained its faithful ally for the entire time he lived. In all probability, the ambassadorship of the Jews conferring with Friedrich III as described by Capsalia was headed by David Mavrogonato in Italian, Morogonato, an adventurer and not overly scrupulous businessman in the service of the Republic of Venice, a person of enormous financial resources and great influence, a native of Candia who was often sent on hazardous missions to the lands of the Aegean and the Great Turk, where he was to run many risks and die a cruel death. On the other hand, he was certainly capable of procuring sumptuous stipends and profitable privileges for himself. Maestro Tobias de Magdeburg, the humble physician from Trent, had seen Mavrogonato at Venice during the days of the imperial visit, although he did not know Mavrogonato's name. He had observed Mavrogonato with respect and reverential fear. He knew approximately where he lived, although he did not know the exact address. But he was well aware that he would never have been able to approach Mavrogonato without undergoing the suspicious appraisal of Mavrogonato's bodyguards. Perhaps Tobias thought that Mavrogonato's recommendation would help get him, Tobias, included in the list of people enjoying the emperor's favor, or those about to receive a doctorate, but he was unable, or did not dare, to ask for it. The personage and appearance of Mavrogonato nevertheless remained imprinted in his memory after many years. In 1475, in speaking to the judges at Trent, he envisioned Mavrogonato as follows, erroneously imagining that he might be still alive. He might have been 44 or 45 years old. He wore his hair long and wore a black beard, like the Greeks. He wore a black cloak that came down to his feet, and covered his head with a black cap. In substance, he dressed like the Greeks. But who was David Mavrogonato really? An ambiguous and mysterious character, Mavrogonato appeared in Venice in 1461 on his own initiative to reveal a conspiracy being hatched on the island of Candia against the Serenissima. The Council of Ten did not hesitate to take the Jewish merchant into its service and send him back to Candia on a secret mission to spy on the conspirators and report them to the Venetian authorities, after gathering the evidence required for their arrest. Mavrogonato carried out the mission to perfection, although his tireless commitment finally ended by blowing his cover, rendering continued residence on his native island impossible, since, as he claimed, both Greeks and Jews pointed him out with their fingers, considering him a vile informer, or malshim in Jewish juridical terminology, a term with lethal penal implications. We also note that Mose Capsaly, rabbi at Constantinople, had threatened Mavrogonato with excommunication at the request of the Jews of Candia. The privilege is requested early in his career by Mavrogonato in return for services rendered were granted without delay and with expressions of profound gratitude by the Council of Ten in December of 1463. These rites, which extended to his sons Jacob and Eliezer and his descendants in perpetuity, included, among other things, exemption from the wearing of the distinctive sign required of the Jews, and authorization to move about armed wherever he wished. He was not, however, granted the privilege, odd in appearance, but perfectly consistent with the type of persons with whom he had to deal, of striking two names off the list of banned persons wanted by the Serenissima for the crime of homicide. Mavrogonato, judeus decreti et mercator in Venetiis, knew full well who might have benefited from such a clause, and had very definite ideas about certain people condemned in absentia who might thus have been permitted to return to the territories under Venetian domination. At this point, the entrepreneurial Jew from Candia, a permanent resident of Venice since the beginning of 1464, traveling frequently and easily, supervising his goods and entering and leaving the port en route for Candia and Constantinople, was officially a spy in the service of the Republic and at its disposal for other, more or less hazardous, secret missions. In effect, Mavrogonato is thought to have been sent to Candia and Constantinople at least four times, in 1465, the next year, in 1468 and in 1470, during the First Venetian-Turkish War. It is possible that, in 1468, on the eve of Friedrich's imperial visit to Venice, Mavrogonato may have accompanied a vessel, loaded with goods owned by himself, from Candia to the Venetian landing place. In June of 1465, a decree signed by the Council of Ten officially admitted that Mavrogonato had been sent to the capital of the Great Turk to spy on the enemy. In 1466, he was referred to the Jew from Crete, called David, called upon by Venice to participate in the peace negotiations with the Sultan Muhammad II. David Mavrogonato died as mysteriously as he had lived, probably during his fourth mission. On the 18th of December 1470, the Doge of Venice, writing to the Duke of Crete, mentioned the death of his secret agent, but without providing any details as to the circumstances of his death. Mavrogonato may have accepted the dangerous assignment of plotting the Great Turk's assassination in one way or another, and may for some reason have failed in the mission, meeting an unexpected death in the process. Other, later, clues are also thought to point in this direction. Among the requests filed by Mavroganato with the Council of Ten after his first secret mission to Candia in the years 1461 to 1462, was that of being permitted to avail himself of a bodyguard, assigned to his personal defense, that you might deign to grant him the privilege of keeping some person near him for the safety of his person, so that no violence or ignominy may be done to him by some villain or other evil person. Once his petition had been accepted by the Venetian legal authorities in February 1464, the merchant from Candia made haste to appoint a person originally described as a sort of bodyguard, but referred to in the document as Mavroganato's associate, a designation quite distinct in scope as well as quality. This bodyguard, or associate, was to share in almost all the privileges granted by the city of Venice to Mavroganato, including that of being authorized to engage in business of any kind, on a basis of equality with Venetian merchants, and being permitted to move about the city and territory wearing the black hat of a Christian gentleman instead of the crocus-colored beret of the Jews. For this reason, Mavroganato, in Venice and its domains, was known as Moriberti. Mavroganato was an experienced and rich businessman, but not a muscular street fighter or expert in the martial arts. These latter services were to be provided by a man bearing the name of Salomone Lupio di Sacco, known throughout Venice and the entire Veneto region as a banker, merchant and rough and ready financier, as bold as he was unscrupulous. Starting in 1464 and continuing thereafter, Mavroganato is thought to have entrusted his affairs to Salomone Lupio di Sacco during his enforced and prolonged absences from Venice, including the management of his lordly dwelling at San Cassian and his joint interest in commercial ventures undertaken on the maritime routes to the great markets of the Levant. Finally, Mavroganato is also believed to have entrusted Salomone Lupio with some of his own precious secrets as a diplomatic spy in the pay of Venice. On the eve of his first, risky trip to Constantinople in June 1465, David Mavroganato informed the Council of Ten that he had indeed confirmed Salomone as his business agent at Venice due to the complete faith which I have in him. Salomone's ancestors had arrived in Italy in the last part of the 14th century from the Rhine region in Germany, perhaps from the same important seat of the Archbishop of Cologne. The family had gradually extended its offshoots from Cervedal del Fiuli, where Mercutio Mordecai and Fais, Salomone's father and grandfather respectively, had operated in the local money market, to Padua, where, in the mid-15th century, the same Salomone managed the Bank of San Lorenzo in the city district of the same name. Salomone and his clan formed part of a migratory flow extending to all regions of northern Italy since the very late 14th century, involving the massive transalpine migration of entire German-speaking communities, both Christians and Jews, from the Rhineland, Bavaria and Upper and Lower Austria, Franconia and Alsace, the Canton, Styria and Thuringia, Slovenia, Bohemia and Moravia, Silesia, Swabia and Saxony, Westphalia, Württemberg in the Palatinate, Brandenburg, Baden, Worms, Regensburg and Spira. A heterogeneous German-speaking population, made up of rich and poor, entrepreneurs and artisans, financiers and scoundrels, men of religion, adventurers and rascals, travelling from the Transalpine territories via the mountain crossings in a process of long duration, towards the lagoons of Venice, as well as the cities and lesser centers of the terra firma of the Veneto region. This was a large-scale phenomenon containing a large Jewish component which had already come to the fore in the regions of northern Italy, in consequence of the persecutions following the Black Death in the mid-14th century as well as sporadically during the century before. Ashkenazi, that is, German, Jewish communities of diverse numerical consistency, formed in a myriad of localities, large and small, from Pavia to Cremona, from Bassano to Treviso, from Cervedel to Chiusia and Trieste, from Udine and Pordenone to Conegliano, from Felta and Vicenza to Rovigo, from Lentinara to Barrier Palisine, from Padua and Verona to Mesta. Here they stayed, a stone's throw from Venice, an enterprising Jewish community of considerable economic weight, whose members came mostly from Nuremberg and the adjacent areas. In 1382, a few Jews from Mystri obtained authorization to move to Venice to practice money lending, but were expelled a few years later, in 1397. For failing to comply with the conditions under which the government of Venice had admitted them to the city. The Syrianissima thus returned to its traditional policy of refusing to grant permanent residence to Jews on the banks of the Great Canal, except under exceptional circumstances and for periods of short duration. This policy, frequently quite contrary to actual practice, witnessed Jews crowding the streets of certain city districts during the day and remaining there in great numbers even after dark, lodged in houses and inns, sometimes for long periods of time. There was no shortage of Jews in Venice, mostly physicians, influential merchants and bankers, having established themselves more or less permanently at Venice. The numerical consistency of this community, heterogeneous in professions but more or less homogeneous in ethnic origin, originating from the Transalpine German-speaking territories, has, until today, been considered from an unjustly simplistic point of view. Beginning in the second half of the 15th century, they tended to gather in one particular strategic area, a sheltered location in the international market at Rialto, the node of the great trading systems linking the city of Venice, by land and sea, to the centers of the plains of the Po River Valley and the German-speaking regions which constituted a constant point of economic, social and religious reference, towards which the eyes of these Ashkenazi Jews continued to be directed. These areas included the districts of Sankishan, where a kosher butcher's shop soon opened, preparing meat according to the Jewish custom, Sant'Agostino, San Polo and Santa Maria Mater Domini. At San Polo, they probably also attended the German Rite Synagogue, authorized by the Venetian government in 1464 to serve the Jews who reside in the capital or who meet there to carry on their businesses, with a decree which nevertheless limited their liturgical collective meetings to the participation of 10 adults of the male sex. Moreover, the Jewish community at Venice, like the others of more or less distant Ashkenazi origin to be seen in the more immediate and smaller centers of northern Italy, formed part of a German-Jewish coin, consisting of German-speaking Jews on both sides of the Alps, linked by liturgical usages and similar customs, sharing the same history, often marked by events both tragic and invariably mythologized, as well as by the same attitude of harsh hostility to the arrogant Christianity of surrounding society, the same religious texts of reference, the same rabbinical hierarchies, produced by the Ashkenazi Talmudic academies to whose authority they intended to submit, and the same family structures. These communities made up a homogeneous entity from the social and religious point of view, which might be called supranational, in which the Jews of Pavia identified themselves with those from Regensburg, the Jews from Treviso with the Jews of Nuremberg, and the Jews of Trent with those from Cologne and Prague, but certainly not with those from Rome, Florence, or Bologna. Relations with the Italian Jews who often lived alongside them, where such relations existed, were markedly fortuitous, based on contingent common needs of an economic nature, and the common perception of being viewed as identical by the surrounding Christian environment. Many of these Ashkenazi Jews did not speak Italian, and if or when they did speak it, it was difficult to understand them due to the heavy German inflection of their pronunciation and the many Germanic and Yiddish terms with which their phrases were cram-packed. Not only the Hebrew language, but the common liturgical usage of German and Italian Jews was pronounced in a radically different way, so that the two groups considered it impossible to pray together. It is not therefore surprising that Italian Jews were not on terms of much familiarity with German Jews. Despite their close proximity, the Italian Jews had little knowledge of the German ones, distrusted their aggressive economic audacity, which generally had little respect for the nation's laws, and dissented from their religious orthodoxy, which they considered exaggerated and depressing. Sometimes, rightly or wrongly, they feared them. The Italian Jewish coin, that is, of distant Roman origin, Jews active in the money trade only moved from Rome to seek permanent residence in the municipalities of central and northern Italy starting in the second half of the 13th century, lived side by side with the German Jewish coin of more recent origin, but without assimilating, without merging and without being influenced, except to a minor and quite secondary degree. They were distant brothers, even if they were not brothers who hate and fear each other. The first group of Roman Jews, that is, Jews of Italian origin, flowing into the centers of the plain of the Po from their preceding seats in the Patrimonio of San Pietro, in Umbria, in the Marca d'Ancona, in the Lazio and in Campagna to carry on the authorized money trade, that is, regulated by permits, did not reach these regions simultaneously with the arrival in those regions of the German Transalpine Jews, active in the same profession. They in fact preceded them by several decades. The first Jewish moneylenders at Padua and Lanigo, in the Vasontino region, were Italians, and initially settled there between 1360 and 1370. Jews of German origin only reached the region in consistent numbers at a later time, at the end of the century, and, in particular, at the beginning of the 15th century. A comparison of the clauses of the permits granted to the German Jews compared to those granted to the Italian Jews, often active in the same areas, reveals obvious traces of profound differences in religious usage and mentalities, sediments of particular and diverse historical experiences. The attitudes and ceremonial components, the fears and mistrust, the meaning and dimensions of life, the relations with the surrounding Christian society of these German Jews, immersed in the new Italian reality in which they felt profoundly foreign, remained influenced and marked by their experiences in the Germanic world from which they originated, and which they had only left physically. The principal concern of these immigrants seemed to be, understandably, that of ensuring their physical safety and the protection of their property against the dangers represented by a surrounding society which considered them treacherous and potentially hostile. Almost obsessively, the chapters of the permits repeatedly mentioned the exemplary punishments to be threatened to anyone causing harm or injury to the Jews, or subjecting them to trouble or vexations. The permit granted by the municipality of Wien to the moneylender Benedict Oder Regensburg in 1444 contained the condition that wet nurses and Christian personnel in the service of the Jews were not to be molested or offended, nor could they be made to work on Sunday or the feast days of the Christian calendar. The Transalpine Jews were particularly sensitive to the possibility of being falsely accused and, in consequence, of suffering from legal proceedings and expropriations, as shown by their preceding experience in the German territories, the scars of which they still bore. In 1414, Salomon de Nuremberg and his companions requested and obtained a concession from the government of Trieste stating that, if Jews were accused of any crime or offense before the judges of that city, they would not be subjected to torture to extort confessions without at least four citizen witnesses, trustworthy and of good reputation, against them. The permits signed by the municipalities of Lombardy and Trevenato with the Ashkenazi Jews were characterized by a constant concern that they be guaranteed the freedom to observe their religious ritual and ceremonial standards with zealous scrupulousness. The religious clauses inserted in the chapters were more detailed in this sense than those found in the contemporary permits granted to Jewish moneylenders of Italian origin, undoubtedly an indication of greater adherence to the observation of religious precepts on the part of the Ashkenazi community than the Italian one. It was significant in this regard that the appearance of the clause relating to the undisturbed provision of kosher meat, that is, meat butchered according to ritual law, appears for the first time in the permits granted to German Jews at the end of the 14th century, from Pavia in 1387 to Udine in 1389. From Pordenone in 1399 to Treviso in 1401, approximately 20 years before this made its initial appearance, certainly in imitation of, and under the influence by, the Ashkenazi prototype, in the permits of the Italian Jews. The religious clauses inserted in the permits of the German Jews include, in addition to the right to supply themselves with kosher meat to observe their festivities freely, the right not to be compelled to violate the standards of Hebraic law in the exercise of their lending activities or having to appear in court on Saturday or the feast days of the Hebraic calendar. The same clauses furthermore permitted the safeguarding of the other Jewish alimentary norms, such as the supervised preparation of the wine, cheeses and bread, a clause usually missing from the permits granted to Italian Jews, the right to attend synagogue, Pavia 1387, to use a piece of land as a cemetery and to permit Jewish women to take regular baths of purification, after the end of their menstrual periods, in the city baths on particular days set aside for them, Pordenone, 1452. But the most characteristic clause, absolutely generalized in the permits of Jews of German origin, but significantly absent from the permits of the Italian Jews, was that referring to protection against forced conversions to Christianity. In particular, the Ashkenazi appeared obsessed with the possibility that their children might be kidnapped, subjected to violence or swindled with snares and tricks to drag them to the baptismal font. That this possibility was anything but remote seemed obvious to anyone having had this type of traumatic experience at first hand on the banks of the Rhine or the Main. Permits issued in Fulia, Lombardy and Veneto granted to German moneylenders, as early as the end of the 14th century, explicitly prohibited friars and priests of any order from proselytizing among Jewish children not yet having reached their 13th birthday. In 1403, Ulrich III, Bishop of Bresianen, granted the Jews of the Tyrol protection from any possible ecclesiastical claims to a right of forced conversion of Jewish children. This protection could, and did, include the dangers represented by baptized Jews, zealous and implacable in plotting the ruin of the Jewish communities from which they originated. In 1395, Minna Adelbach, representing the Jewish families of German origin residing in Gemona, first stopping place on the main road to the lagoons of Venice after the mountain crossing of Tarvisio, obtained, in the initial clauses of their permits, explicit provision for the immediate removal from the city of so-called Jews turned Christian, who were said to constitute elements of scandal and disturbance. The die was already cast between the Italian and German Jews, settled in the lands beyond the River Po, by the mid-15th century. With a few exceptions, the piazza was henceforth solidly in the hands of Yiddish-speaking Jews who, in the best of cases, spoke badly mangled Italian. In former times, they had crossed the Alps fearfully and almost on tiptoe, in search of sufficiently modest and desirable dwellings so as to live and survive comfortably, but they also, when need arose, proved themselves enterprising in financial matters, courageous and even bold in their commercial undertakings, nonchalant and often arrogant and impudent in their relations with the government, only obeying the law when it was strictly necessary or too dangerous to do otherwise. Victory was now theirs, and it was because of these same bankers and merchants that many of them had been able to accumulate huge sums of capital in a relatively short lapse of time, such as to bear no comparison with the fortunes possessed by Christian mercantile families and patricians who were both more distinguished and of higher rank. The chronology is relatively precise. In 1455, all Italian Jews active in the money trade were expelled from Padua and compelled to shut down their banks, while the Teutonic Jews, divided from, and now entirely separate from, the Italian Jews, gained the upper hand in the local money market, Padua, the most important in the terra firma of the Veneto region, as early as 10 years before. At Verona, all lending banks owned by Italian Jews had already been closed in 1447, while, in 1445, the permits of the Jewish bankers of Vicenza were not renewed. With the Italian Jewish banks shut down in all the principal centers of the Veneto region, a few district lending banks, few in number but of great economic potential, particularly because of the higher interest rates charged by them in comparison to the rates formerly charged by banks controlled by Italian Jews, remained open to serve the needs of the clientele in the cities and in the countryside. These were the banks of Soave and Villafranca in the district of Verona, Mesta for Venice, and Ist, Campo Zampiro and, above all, Piove di Sacco in the Padua district. The forced and almost simultaneous dismantling of the Jewish banks of Padua, Verona and Vicenza led, as an immediate consequence, to the almost total extinction of the Hebraic community of Roman origin, which was compelled, for the most part, to flow into the centers on the nearer side of the Po. On the other hand, however, it allowed other money lenders, from Treviso and the territories of Fulia, who took over the assets and management of the few remaining lending banks, to make extraordinary fortunes. As we have seen, these banks benefited from an extremely broad catchment area and could rely on a numerous and heterogeneous clientele. Their economic success was therefore guaranteed and proved to be exceptional in scope. The lucky few bankers remaining on the piazza were almost all Ashkenazi, the same Jews who had hastened or more or less